Welcome to the Powell House Press podcast. Today we'll listen to Joshua Powell's memoir, Father and Son. You can also read this and other works of Joshua's at Medium and Substack. His handle is jdpowell65@gmail.com. This is Father and Son. Chapter 3. Summer 2012, I was still in that space between sleep and wake, where my dreams started to be pushed aside by the sounds of the rising morning birds and the dim light from the sun's bright rise. I heard a beep from downstairs. The coffee maker had just gone on. I rolled over and tried to catch a little more sleep, but it was useless. I sat up, hung my legs over the side of the bed, and sat for a bit. It was no special day. All my days started this way, even on the weekends. But it was no weekend. Max bounced by the kitchen door leading out to the garden when I got downstairs. His tail was wagging, and unlike me, he was not hazed by sleep. I poured a cup of coffee and turned on the television, which hung from under the cupboard near the stove. I watched some news and waited for Max to bark, letting me know he wanted in. Back upstairs, I turned on the shower and walked back into my room and closet. I took out a blue Hugo Boss suit, a white shirt, and a red silk tie with tiny blue embroidered flowers. I also took out socks, underwear, black patent leather Ferragamo shoes, and a matching belt. I laid them all out on the bed and then headed into the shower. When I walked through the door to my office, my assistant Jen looked up from her desk. I've worked with her since my days as a consultant at the hospital, where I designed a spine center and a brain tumor clinic. When I was picked to run Capital Region Special Surgery, a large medical group in upstate New York, I asked her to come along. She's known me and my work habits for over 10 years. I'd have been lost without her. "Good morning, Jen," I said, walking towards her desk. Her arm was outstretched, and she held a folder in her hand. "Good morning. Dr. Ciotti is in your office," she said, her cheerful voice a ruse of sorts. She knew I hated this guy. "Great. How'd he get in there?" I asked, my voice saccharine sweet as well. "He just sauntered in," she said as I took the folder. "I printed out your agenda. It's in there. Also, you have a really tight schedule today, because you have to be at the hospital for the meeting at 1:30, so I'm going to order sushi for you for lunch at 12, unless you plan to eat at the hospital," she asked. "No hospital food. Sushi, please," I said, taking out my wallet and giving her my Amex. Jen nodded, and I walked into my office, where Dr. Ciotti was sitting across from my empty desk. "Good morning. What brings you to my office?" I asked as I sat behind my large, empty glass-topped desk on two chrome sawhorses. He was unaware that no one just walked into my office, not that there was anything to spy on or discover. Jen scanned all my files into a secure server, and the hard copies were shredded. If I had left things on my desk, they would have been read by now. Siad was that kind of person. I am sure he read his sister's diary growing up. "Josh," he started, "I want to make an official complaint against Dr. Clapper," he said, clearly agitated, which seemed his go-to demeanor. "And what would that be?" I asked. While I was no fan of Clapper's, I would take him over Siad any day of the week. "He has an Israeli flag on his desk," Ciotti said, as if it was a decapitated human head on his desk. I sat back, took a deep breath, and noticed he was wearing a button-down collared shirt with his suit and tie. So many of these young doctors think that having an MD and a big paycheck made them sophisticated and worldly, but they all had tells. Siad's button-down shirt and copious amounts of Polo cologne were the residue of growing up poor in Syracuse. Being a physician might be the on-ramp to wealth, but without a personal Professor Higgins, he would never get away from where he came from. "Ciotti, he has a small Israeli flag in his penholder. I don't see the issue," I said, leaning forward. "Josh, I'm Palestinian," he said with so much pseudo-indignity, I almost laughed. "I understand, Ciad, but he is Jewish. If you like, you can have a Palestinian flag in your mock office. The key word is office. This is not the Gaza Strip, and I am the CEO, not the HR director. If you want to make a complaint, that is where you belong. Not in my office. I really don't like your tone. Remember, I am the physician here," he said, pulling out the God card. "Ciad, you are an employee here, not a partner like Dr. Clapper or an officer like me. If you want to pursue this, do so. But this is not the way to become a partner when the time comes. Now, if you will excuse me, I have a busy day." I looked at my watch. It was 8:30. and I believe you have an office full of patients starting now. He left in a huff, and I opened the file. My day was shit. Meeting with the risk management consultant at 9, then a settlement conference related to another one of our surgeons who accidentally paralyzed a 40-year-old man, then the hospital. By the time I got to the hospital for the meeting, I was as calm as a cucumber. The meeting was in a typical hospital conference room, long tables with seats, a large screen in front, and a folding table along the back with bottles of water and a large bowl filled with snacks like Doritos, potato chips, and the like. Neurosurgeon Dr. Steve Moore was sitting towards the front. He had two bottles of water and two bags of chips. He was still in his scrubs, as this was one of his OR days. Usually, neither one of us attended these meetings, but he was there because we were reviewing brain tumors. "Hey," I said, sitting down next to him. "Hey, how are you?" he asked. "It's been a fun day so far." "Yeah, I heard about Siad. He's an asshole," Steve said. In the surgery world, neurosurgeons are like tigers, the big cats, whereas ENTs, which was Siad's discipline, are more like bobcats. We called them the snot jockeys. "Who told you?" I asked, but I was not surprised by how news travels at the office. "Jen, I called to find you when you were meeting with the lawyers, and she filled me in. You're not upset with her, are you?" "God, no. I told her the story. You're entitled to know, Dr. President," I teased. 15 minutes later, I was standing at the podium, running through my slides on 8 cases of glioblastomas operated on at the hospital over the past 6 months, finishing with the survival rate, which was 50%, and then shared that we anticipated 100% mortality within the next 18 months. I then asked the sea of white coats if there were any questions. Hands went up, but they belonged only to the residents who only asked questions to prove how astute they were to their attendings. My iPhone came to life on the podium, vibrating with a light noise. It was Mom. I ignored it. Immediately, it vibrated again. It was Mom again. I turn off my phone. By the time the meeting ended, it was almost 3. Steve returned to the OR to finish his last case, and I slithered through the hospital's back hallways to the parking garage, hoping not to run into anyone. I just wanted to return to work, check my messages, and go home. When I got in the car, I turned my phone back on and plugged it into the dashboard. On the display, I saw 7 missed calls and 3 voicemails. Before I could listen to any of the messages or see what numbers had called, Jen, my secretary, called. "Hey Jen, what's up?" I asked. "Sorry to call you. I know you're busy, but your mother called 3 times looking for you. She asked me to call you. She said she thought you were ignoring her. I told her you were in a meeting, but she insisted I call you. I guess she doesn't believe you were at the hospital," Jen said with a knowing lilt. "I don't want to be on the bad side of your mother," she continued with a small, nervous laugh. No one wanted to be on the wrong side of Mom. "I get it, Jen. No worries," I said sympathetically and then said goodbye. I hit the button on the steering wheel, which looked like a phone. "Call Mom," I commanded. "Calling Mom," the car answered. "Hi, Mom, what's up?" I asked, my eyes rolled, reflexively. "You will not believe this," she started. Her tone was a mix of disgust and exasperation. "What?" I asked. It was impossible for me ever to know what would cause her ire. "Well, today Joe and I went to the country store for coffee," she said, pausing to collect herself. She and my stepfather, Joe, went to the Old Chatham Country Store every morning for coffee. Old Chatham is a quaint hamlet in the upper Hudson Valley. I grew up there, and as a teenager, I worked at the country store as a stock boy. It was hard to imagine anything too controversial associated with getting coffee at the OCCS. "Mom, what is it?" "I just left a long meeting," I said, frustrated. Most people would have taken the clue to hang up, but not Mom. "Well, do you have a few minutes?" It was not a question. As I said, Joe and I went for coffee. "Can you believe that there was no sweet and low?" she said in her breathy voice. "And?" I asked, feeling the vein on the side of my head pulse. "Joshua, there was no sweet and low. I mean, it's like a bar without beer. It's irresponsible." "Mom, I have to go," I said, annoyed. "You know, you're becoming a very insensitive man, and I think that is the first step to becoming arrogant. No one will want to know you." She hung up the phone. By the time I got home, it was close to 6:30 p.m. I stripped off my clothes, hung up the suit, and tossed the shirt into the dry cleaning bag. I put on shorts and a polo shirt, went into the kitchen, made a drink, and walked out onto the deck. I sat on the steps and admired my garden. It was stunning, with beds of hostas, lilies, ornamental maples, and hydrangeas. A few small fountains gurgled, and with the brass tiki torches lit as the night settled in, there was no other place I wanted to be. I built this yard from scratch, spending hours after work and on weekends to make it perfect. And it was, I thought, as I looked around and saw nothing I wanted to change. It was the other side of me, the side that grew up outdoors, the side that liked to use my hands and turn off my brain. My phone vibrated in my pocket. I took it out and looked at the screen. It was Mom. I didn't answer it. Instead, I picked up the sweaty tumbler and drained it in a single gulp. The vodka burned going down. My phone vibrated again, and I hit the red decline button on my iPhone, walked across the deck into the kitchen, and made another drink. I stood at the counter and cut a lime. My phone rang again. It was Mom. I slid the phone back into my pocket, walked outside, and sat back on the step. The phone vibrated again. I ignored it again. I unraveled the earphones in my pocket, popped them into my ears, and played Fleetwood Mac's Rumors. The vodka was improving the night as I began to unwind and listen to Christine McVie. And the songbirds are singing, like they know the score. And I love you, I love you, I love you, like never before. And then the music stopped because Mom was fucking relentless and her call silenced the music. Jesus fucking Christ, I said out loud to no one. Max looked up at me. I ignored the call and tried to catch the vibe I had been feeling, but typical of Mom, she cast her spell, and just like that, I got that pit in my stomach. It's a pit that only a Powell child knows. The peace of sitting in my yard enjoying a drink with Max was not even a vapor. It is like a great dream that gets interrupted when I wake up and fades before I can remember it. My mood tanked. The fucked up part was that I always felt guilty when I disappointed her, even in situations like the sweet and low. Non-controversy. She trained all of us to feel guilt when we committed some minuscule offense towards her. Even those offenses that existed only in her mind. On the deck steps, I drank more. The guilt became a riptide, dragging me deeper back in time. There was no fighting her wake. I pulled my iPhone out of my pocket and called her back. Hello, she answered, and it was evident that she'd been into the wine, which was a given at 7:34 p.m. Usually, she started around 3 in the afternoon. Hi, Mom. What's up? Silence. Mom? Hello? I wish you were never born, she said in her husky, drunken voice. Still, she eliminated any ambiguity that this might be a drunk dial. I'm serious. I wish I never gave you life, and I don't like you. Mom, what are you talking about? I asked. I knew this side of her, and for the rest of the conversation, I defended myself as if I was bleeding out after being stabbed in the neck. Your sister mailed me your bloggerings, she hissed. What bloggerings? I asked, but I knew what she was talking about. I had been posting stories about Dad and what it was like growing up with him on Blogger. But my fatal error, my sin, was that I had not supported Mom's long-held public relations campaign about Dad. To her, this was treason. A lot of what Mom said about Dad was true, but it was usually only a fraction of the truth. He was an accomplished artist, but this was only a part of my father's life. I learned that Mom's story of Dad and their perfect marriage was just that, a story. I was telling why Dad was famous for a different reason than being an accomplished artist. I was writing about Dad's murders. I don't understand how you could write such things. And while she posed the question, I knew she was not looking for an answer. When Mom drank, she repeated herself. So I got another round of, I wish you were never born. Mom, I think it's important for all of us to know our history, I said, trying to reason with her, which was insanity because there was no reasoning with my mother about Dad, who died in 1976. Not then, in 2012, not ever. The truth meant nothing. It's not your history. Yes, Mom, it is. Silence. You know what, Joshua? I don't like you. I don't. And the line went dead. I'm 45 years old. I deal with horrible people at work. I record data on gruesome deaths. I deal with life-shattering lawsuits, and I am the epitome of equanimity. But my mother can still reduce me to tears. I chucked the phone across the yard, and Max jumped up and ran after it as if I was tossing a tennis ball for him to fetch. Rage bubbled up in me. What the fuck was wrong with Lucy? no matter how hard we tried to get Mom to learn the internet, use email, or, God forbid, social media, her response was always the same. This computer stuff is a fad. That's why I was confident she'd never see my blog. That's why I felt comfortable writing about what I had learned about Dad. How had Lucy even seen it? But to print it out and mail it to Mom? What the fuck? Max trotted up from the lawn, my phone in his mouth, his tail wagging. He dropped the phone and danced in place, wanting me to toss it again. But instead, I picked it up, wiped it off on my shorts, and dialed Lucy. "Hello, brother," she answered in a sing-song voice. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I screamed into the phone. Silence. "Seriously, Lucy, you told Mom about the blog?" I was incredulous. "How the hell did you even know about it?" "She had every right to read what you've been posting, so yeah, I printed them out and sent them to her." Her tone changed. She was not defensive, but cold. "You have no right to write about Daddy that way," she said. Her voice cracked when she said, "Daddy, he was so good to me, and you write about what a monster he was. He wasn't. So, you think you know more about my relationship with Dad than I do?" I was shaking with anger. Max slinked up the deck stairs and lay down under the table. He wanted no part of my increasingly rising, angry voice. "I don't believe what you're writing. I don't know why you are, but you are hurting the entire family," she spat into the phone. "And what do you know about this family, Lucy?" "Huh? You don't talk to Leah. Mom wouldn't talk to you for what? 15 years? And now that you and Mom talk, do you think you have the right to decide what I would share with her? You can't just let there be peace, can you? You knew how Mom would react, and still, you fucking blow my life up?" I screamed into the phone, and the line went dead. Next door, the porch light went on, and I heard the yawn of a screen door opening as the returning spring stretched tight. "All okay over there?" my neighbor Rich asked across the driveway. "Ah, yeah, all's good. It's just a heated conversation with my sister. Sorry if it got too loud," I answered. "Oh, no worries. I just wanted to be sure all is okay there, neighbor." The screen door frame slapped the jamb, and the porch light went out. I picked up my phone and texted Lucy. "You bitch. Get some help. What's wrong with her?" But I knew the answer to that question. Years ago, Mom testified against her at a custody hearing, deciding if Lucy's daughter was to live with Lucy or her ex-husband. Lucy lost, and her daughter Alicia was given to her father. It was my mother's testimony that swayed the judge. Lucy and my mother stopped talking for 15 years. It was no estrangement. It was a pus-filled wound for Lucy, a mix of the loss of her daughter and Mom's betrayal, all stemming from the years after Dad died. Now back in Mom's good graces, whatever that meant, Lucy was desperate to please her, anything to be back in my mother's life. It was as if Mom could only love two of her children at a time. It was always this way. That's why Lucy orchestrated a rift with Mom and me. It made room for her in Mom's life. I was just collateral damage. God, how did we survive our childhoods? But that's my parents for you, be it from the grave or old Chatham. They were electromagnets to their children's emotional compasses. They never let us kids know a true emotional north. My phone pinged. It was Lucy. "If you hated him so much, if Dad was so horrible to you, why were you hysterical at his wake and the morning he died?" "Good question," I thought as I got up and walked into the kitchen. I filled my glass with ice and just vodka and entered my study. I picked up my phone and started to finger out a text. "Lucy, people can be different from one person to another. Dad might have been a great father to you, but it doesn't mean he was to me. This is not about you or Mom. It's about my father and me. It's my memoir, not yours." I sent the text and almost immediately got a reply. "Josh, it's not a memoir. It's fiction." My thumbs danced across the surface of my phone. "Lucy, it's pretty fucked up that Mom has created a false narrative about Dad, and we both know that. But jumping on her bandwagon and calling my experiences fiction is stealing from me. It is stealing my life experiences, and you are asking me to adopt yours with Dad. That is fiction, and you know that. And it sucks that you think your experiences and Mom's bullshit are more important than mine. And you know what I am writing is true. You were there a lot of the time. And then there are all the newspaper articles. Are they fiction too?" My phone pinged again. "Josh, you can't have it both ways. You can't be the kid hysterical when your father died and then write this shit about how horrible Dad was to you." Furiously, I banged out another text. Wow, wow. If you think I wanted it both ways, you are more fucked up than I thought. I turned off my phone, sat on the couch, and opened that dark, hidden corner of my mind, which I rarely visited. The place where the bad memories are filed away. I see them like photos in a family album, smiling by the Christmas tree, wearing costumes for Halloween, birthday parties and trips. But there was more to it than pictures glued to black construction paper bound in leather. There were other pictures. That was where the monster lived. That's where I keep Dad now, hidden deep in the dark parts of my memory, far in the past. Thanks for listening. If you missed episodes 1 and 2, you can find them anywhere you get your podcast.